Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Verbal Shenanigans Podcast. It's Scott here. Happy Thanksgiving. Listen to this episode while you're preparing Thanksgiving dinner. Ignore Uncle Larry, who got sauced at dinner and bet the whole farm on the Detroit Lions covering the under. But we are very thankful to be working with several awesome sponsors on this podcast, and one of them happens to be Sleep Ovation. Waking up with back pain, 50% of Americans are. Sleep Ovation's new mattress is 700 tiny mattresses that individually cradle natural curves of your spine. This provides perfect comfort and spine support for back pain relief and the best damn sleep of your life. Pre-order yours now at sleepovation.com. Use the show code VERBAL and get $100 off your order. So see, just by listening to this podcast, you save money on a mattress. So go check out Sleep Ovation. Now, Susan Robb is one of our sponsors, along with the Hippo Guy, Hippo Attack Survivor Paul Templer, and Kim Ward, another guest on our show, have launched the Nepal Outreach Program and really need your donations. Kim Ward, Executive Director of the Templer Foundation, a not-for-profit 501c3, has launched a GoFundMe page under the name Nepal Outreach Program. This program is designed to help specifically women and their children who are homeless. Their mission is to secure a house for the first 15 women and 17 kids and enroll each child in school this year. The first $3,500 raised goes toward tuition for the year for all 17 kids in the program so far. So go check out the Nepal Outreach Program and also check out Susan Robb on LinkedIn. Now, we are lucky to have three brewery sponsors on the podcast. One of them happens to be the Adirondack Brewery, located in beautiful Lake George, New York. Now, they're open Friday and Saturday, but on Sunday, they're going to be having brunch. Adirondack Pub and Brewery has developed a completely unique and absolutely insane brunch menu that they're excited to share with you. Greek toast, huevos rancheros, breakfast tacos, shrimp and grits, much more. No brunch is complete without Bloody Marys and mimosas. You could also expect all their wonderful craft beer to be available and breakfast cocktails. Okay, so brunch is first come, first serve. So check out to get more information, go to the brewery's Facebook page. That is the Adirondack Brewery. Now, Demented Brewing is located in Middlesex, New Jersey, in one of the coolest little breweries in New Jersey. Buildings in New Jersey, I should say. It's got a really awesome mural, 16 rotating tap handles, something released every Sunday. They just released Silent, their single hop Montuica IPA. And this Sunday, they're going to be releasing Wrath, their Russian Imperial Stout. So go down to Demented, have a couple beers on this Thanksgiving weekend. Take the family, Demented Brewing. Manskirt Brewing, located in Hackettstown, New Jersey. Yes, that's correct, Manskirt. If you go there, you'll see Joe in his Manskirt. But they're just an awesome brewery located in the old bank building there on Main Street in Hackettstown, New Jersey. And they always have seasonally inspired ale, rotating taps. They have a lot of events and quiz nights, trivia nights, yoga, bands playing. So Manskirt Brewing is an awesome place to check out. So make sure you go and do that, Manskirt Brewing. Finally, Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Trivia Revolution is a trivia company. I host Wednesdays at Tap House 15, and you can play trivia in beer bars and breweries all over New Jersey. You can be in last place, win prizes. It's just a good night out. There's a bonus item each week. So Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Now, this week on the podcast, I'm sure you are all familiar with The Onion, the nationally known, what was once a newspaper, now website, for their videos and content. We are joined by one of the creators of The Onion, Scott Dickers, for a pretty fascinating interview. So while you're cooking up Thanksgiving dinner, enjoy the podcast.
Hey, this is Scott Dickers, and you don't know me from a hole in the wall, but you've been listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Bagpipe time, that means we talk now.
We're back. Yay!
I'm not cheering.
Well, you're never cheering.
No.
But welcome back, everybody. Welcome to episode 176. Closing in on 200s.
Mm-hmm.
Closing in closer.
We need to get a billboard which has a countdown to 200.
Just fly it outside my house.
Yeah.
On the flagpole.
We'll just buy one of them old ones that used to say how many people died of lung cancer every minute.
And just like spray paint over it.
And then just change it. Yeah.
Rebel Shenanigans. Someone dies every minute. Listeners die every minute.
Mm.
Obi is punching his food bag to get more food.
I'm going to get it, Daddy. It's just a matter of time.
Why, when you come over, or he gets excited, he decides his appetite doubles.
It's just the way of the world when it comes to the
Does your dog do that? Like,
Callie? No.
Does Callie, like, eat right away as soon as the food comes out?
No, all she does is pretty much jump up and welcome me. If I sit down, she'll run over and get right next to me, get some scratches. Obi gets starving.
I sometimes Obi's like, I'm like such old news to him, and he's like, mm-hmm. He doesn't even move when I come in the house. He just like rolls slightly over, and that's like the equivalent of saying, hey. Punching the bag now with his nose. All right, you want an extra scoop? I'll give you an extra scoop if you're going to shut up. Carry the show, Berlo.
Hey, everyone. So, episode 176 here. As in for a job update, I'm doing some interviews. I'm still looking right now. So, trying to get the funds ready and all. As I went out to get beer for tonight's episode.
You got a job at the liquor store.
No. Oh. To add to my thanks for the good luck, My driver's seat is kind of broken where, as I'm driving, it's now like I'm sitting in a rocking chair.
Oh. But it just makes the driving experience more fun. Then.
Yeah, especially if I ever get in an accident, because surely the safest thing to be in is a rocking chair when
well,
you get
it actually is, because it absorbs the contact, and then...
Yeah, but you got to be on the right angle, so I got to hope I got to be in the downward slope
it hits,
when it
and
hits
and you
me.
Just rock with it. You don't even get hurt, I heard. You should probably try.
It's like Granny from the Beverly Hillbillies and all, totally safe. Strap me to the top of the...
Did you know that I might be saying this wrong. My grandmother's aunt, I think, was the grandma in Beverly Hillbillies.
This is a serious
item? Swear to God, yeah. In the original, like, old Beverly Hillbillies.
Was there more than one? The way you said?
I don't know. I just assume there was another one, because they remake everything. But, yep, there were some...
But,
some,
I mean, for the entire series, she played
grandma.
Okay, yep. I wasn't sure you were saying she died and somebody else came
I'll
in.
I'll have to reach out to my aunt. She's like the family historian when it comes to these things. Like, she'll tell me exactly who it is. In fact, what I'm going to do...
She has opened the great book of Brennan with all the Brennan facts.
Blow the dust off of it. In fact, while we're talking, I'm going to text message her. Maybe she can tell me, clarify who was the grandma All right. How was grandma related to the grandma on Beverly Hillbillies? Again.
Ask her if you had any relatives in the show Maud.
And then there's Maud. But so the job search is just kind of going.
Interviews are coming through, still waiting on some more information. I had one face-to-face here in Jersey, so waiting to see if that goes to an offer, but still in limbo right now. Still early in the process,
it hasn't been long.
It's kind of annoying. It's right at the holiday times.
Yeah.
Like, everybody's like, oh, are you excited? No, I'm not.
So Izzy's getting one of those things you do for your mom, like back in like elementary school, like make tickets, like clean, we'll take out trash, like one free back rub.
Oh, no. That's what she told me to like make something. She's like, all right, I don't want you to give me anything for Christmas, and not till we get our funds back. You know, I got so many things for you. And I'm looking at her like, that is going to be the weirdest feeling on the planet.
Make her something from scratch, like, but like that you have no idea how to make, like a canoe from scratch. Yeah.
I think this is the quilt, honey. I'm not really sure.
You have that garage area below your apartment. There's enough room to make a canoe.
I guess so. No, I mean, how much metal do I need for that?
Do like a wood canoe. It's probably even harder. Like real, like handcrafted. like Indian Native American style canoe, like hollow out a tree.
Okay. Well, there are wood trees behind my apartment.
Plenty of them. You could get going.
I'm sure they're for anybody to use.
Maybe that'll inspire you to like reinvent yourself. You know, like I was actually going to talk to
Mike Berlew, canoe maker.
You got to find what you're passionate about in this life, man.
I never really thought about canoes in that fashion.
Well, no, I was going to ask you like with because I know I'm going through this. I'm going through like a little creative rut, like where I don't. I'm very tired of working for somebody and working somebody else's schedule and pretending I care about the company I work for. You know what I mean? Like pretending that I'm motivated to do things. And it's like more and more I think about like, oh, how can I take that leap and do some kind of business on my own? And what would it be? And, you know, you just sit there and you try to rack your ideas. Nothing comes out. You're like, damn, I got nothing. Nowadays, you can get something started on the side pretty quick, like as far as like a website or if you make something, you know, like there's no middleman or whatever. Like, you can at least, like, say you made a canoe, right? You could put up Mike's Canoe website today in about an hour, and you could sell to the people your first prototype for whatever you want, you know?
Mike's Canoe LLC.
You know, you don't have to get a loan, you don't have to get anything. So, I don't know. Does a thought cross your mind? Like, how can I get out of this? Like, is there something else you want to do?
It's in the process. I mean, that was when I had the last job, my thought was to do a year, kind of pay off some bills, get that finalized, and then look for something. I mean, truth be told, I mean, and I'm not sitting back saying, ooh, I love the IT life. I love getting called 3 a.m. because something went down in a place I don't care about. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I can do the job, but literally, I'm still trying to figure out what the next thing is. I can't fathom 65-year-old Berlew getting calls from Rakesh, you know?
Right. Now, is there anything that, like, you've thrown around or thought about? Like, hey, this is what I want to do, possibly, or you still have no idea what the reinvention of Berlew is? It sounds like a movie.
Tonight on Hallmark, a Christmas special. A man's in IT, but he hopes for a new life.
He gets struck by lightning or something, like on your last day on the IT job, and like it opens some kind of like
Rain
superpower.
Wilson is Michael Berlew.
Kevin Spacey plays the ghost of Christmas Past.
Stop touching me! Keep that in the past. What the hell?
No, but I'm just like, is there anything that's like crossed your mind? Because I'm thinking the whole time, like, what can I do? And like, I don't know. Like I think of a lot of things I like to do, but I'm like, how can I make them profitable enough to live off of?
I mean, I would love to do something with like animals, something in that kind of field. I mean, my biggest concern why I don't make this jump is I don't want to lose that much income where it sit back and goes, okay, I'm pretty much as poor as when I don't have a job,
right,
for lack of a better term. So that, I mean, to change a career, that'd be something where I want to be established in the new job, pay off the bills, the credit cards at zero, and say, okay, now I can
open
a
Berlew petting zoo.
Yeah.
How could you make a twist on a petting zoo? How would your petting zoo be different than the average carnival petting zoo?
Nothing but insects. Cockroaches.
Pet the ant. Somehow, I don't know if that's going to get you worldwide business.
Aw, come on. Pet the silverfish. Come on now.
What if you went like fetishy and every animal you had there, like someone could get in costume and interact with the animal?
All right. We've been down this man pup road many times.
You don't have to be the man pup.
Yeah, but I still don't want my career involved in man pumping. God bless Kaz James. Go out and buy his book on Amazon right now. But that is not the career path that Berlew is following right now.
For a second, he said man pumping. I was like, oh, that's a whole other, business you can get into.
Oh! Light bulb goes off. Bing! And that's how I made my billions, grandchildren. Grandpa, you know the law says you can't tell us that story anymore.
It's not even like making billions. I would just like to be like, I don't want to be 60 years old and be like, man, I played it safe my whole life. Like, I never like took a risk and tried something. Like, I don't know. Like, I remember back in the day, I was really seriously thinking about doing like a small brewery and start, like I was reading a lot of literature on it and stuff like that. And I was really into brewing, and then that kind of went by the wayside for a while. And I'm like, man, that would have been cool to. I mean, what's the worst that could happen? You fail?
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean,
also, we're also in a state which is god awful in so many laws and regulations and stuff where you can't put it in certain places or whatever. Like, I had a friend who came down two weeks ago. She was at Winbur Lose a Draw, my friend Ashley, and she's out in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And we were asking her what's out there and stuff. And she said there's like a brewery across the street from a church, because in Montana they don't have the 8 billion zoning laws which say, oh, you can't be here, you must be X amount of distance and be this wide and be this calculation off from any children walking by and stuff like that. So
yeah, I mean, it's something I'd always
Jersey's not forgiving
thought about doing. They've lightened a lot of the brewery laws over the last couple of years, so they wouldn't even have to be in New Jersey, like if the opportunity was somewhere
else. Obviously,
you know?
But that kind of adds to, if you want to do a brewery, this is probably not the best state to do it. And then you have to see if a connecting one is easy enough where you stay here, or do you make that huge jump?
It's all about, like, the nervousness of getting the money together, you know? I mean, like getting loans and being like, oh,
hey,
crap.
Hey, Sleep Ovation.
Yeah.
Opening a brewery.
But
it's weird. The other breweries won't sponsor my brewery.
Yeah, and not even just a brewery per se. Like, I always wanted to do something. Like, where can I do it? And I just, you sit there. I feel like if you keep thinking about it, it never comes. But, like, something just pops into your head. He's going back at the food again. But
get it, Rocky.
But I don't know, like, oh, this son of a bitch.
It's almost like he's pressing into a typewriter. That's the kind of noise he's getting into. Stop. As Scott has given in to his child dog. Oh, no, he put it up on the counter.
Yeah.
And now Obi is looking at the plastic container of food and trying to figure out how to hit that to bother you.
Update to follow.
Obi's like, I'll figure this out.
But I don't know. Like, I go through this a lot. Like, I go through little, like, ruts of being like, like, I gotta do something different. Like, I gotta do something else. I don't want my life to be like, oh, you spent 25, 30 years at the same job.
But you look at, like, our Manskirt Brewery, Joe Fisher, he had a regular time job, and he started his brewery, and he built it up to the point where he just does Manskirt now. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the kind of thing. It's not only having a plan, it's, as you say, getting the fundings, and you probably have to come up with a plan with, all right, I got to do X amount of time in a regular job, then X amount of time in my passion, and pray in X amount of time the passion comes through.
I know, I don't. But I always think of, like even, like, the ringmaster guy, Jonathan
Lee Iverson.
Yeah. When he was talking about how a lot of times people's passion, they don't go for it and they go for the secondary plan, like, it's the safer plan. And he's right, man. Like, how many people you know, like, oh, man, he used to like to do this, and then they just kind of fizzle down, they go have a family, and they work the same job until they're old and gray, and that's it, you know? Like, it's funny because my dad's like the opposite. He started his own business, had it for 25 years, and then lost the business. And then had to go get another job with BMW now for 20 years and hopefully retiring this year. But at least he tried it, you know? Like, at least he raced us on it, you know, up until I was about 15, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what he did. He had his own business. Worked his ass off, but.
Yeah, it's also a different time and where nowadays it's like, what do you mean you don't have these 20 certificates and these 10 licenses and these 50. PhDs and whatever. I mean, it was a different time where it's just literally like, you can like, oh, I could build a, like a toy car. And then you could just sell it from your house. And
Burlew's toy cars?
Yeah.
Got a good ring to it.
Yeah. They're going to be great. I'm going to call them Hot Wheels.
Just make General Lee's with the new flag on them and be like, they're like
a white person and a black person hugging on the hood.
Cultural, appropriate. Like, go back in time and take, like, all shows that had, like, things that nowadays were, like, looked down upon and change them and just release new toys of them featuring
All in the Family, Love the Eye Community set.
Social justice warrior toys. Mm. But I don't know. All right, Berlo, it is guest time.
Who we got, Scotty?
So you're familiar with the Onion, correct?
I like onions.
No, not the food, the onions. The Onion.
Which one on your counter?
The Onion. The paper. The website.
Oh. Still not getting it.
Well, for those of you who do know what I'm talking about, we have the founder of the world's first humor website, theonion.com, which is still up and running, and you still see things come across your Facebook feed all the time, like onion stories. We have Mr. Scott Dickers coming on to the podcast. I know Scott has done a bunch of things in comedy, has done things for Saturday Night Live, but the main thing here, he was the founder and editor of The Onion on and off a couple times, so I'm excited to talk to him.
Yeah, so should be fun.
So let's get Scott on. Scott Dickers, what's up, man?
Not much. Am I audible?
You are audible. You sound good.
Do I sound lovely or do I sound adequate?
You sound mystical.
You know what? I'm going to just check my preferences here.
Mystic, you're going to set it for lovely?
Because I do not. Mystical is not the sound I'm going for.
No, you sound good, man. Mm.
I mean, like I have a microphone or like I'm talking to my computer mic?
It sounds like you have a microphone. Yeah. You sound pretty clear.
All right. Then I'm going to assume that, yeah, I'm on the mic. Okay. So, well, because you never know. You hook up the mic, but then Skype doesn't have it set to the mic. Anyway, so I'm here. Mic. I'm very sorry.
Oh,
I'm
no problem.
Late.
No problem.
Everybody's fine.
All right. Good. As long as you're all good and,
yes,
you know, nothing is a drastic emergency. Mm. So
it's all good.
So, Scott, where are you calling from? Chicago, I think.
That is where I live, Chicago, Illinois. Correct.
So, is it
not a great town?
No,
no.
Well, no. Other than the murders, they say it's pretty nice.
You know, the murders per capita, I don't know that they're any worse than DC or Detroit or some of the other big cities, but you know, and there have been some like muggings in my neighborhood, but generally, I live in a really quiet neighborhood. There's not a lot of gang activity right outside my house. I think that's where most of the murders are happening. Mm. But no, it's just like, you know, everybody who lives in Chicago, if you ask them to a person, they'll say, oh, I love Chicago so much. And I just don't get it. It's not that great.
So why stay out there?
Well, I got family here. You know, you can't just uproot a kid and take him out of school. Like, it's a big deal, you
right,
know?
Right. Did you grow up there?
No. I came here about 5 years ago when The Onion decided to merge its editorial office in New York with its business office in Chicago. And they wanted all the writers to come from New York to Chicago. Nobody wanted to come, obviously, because all writers want to be in New York.
Right.
Hmm. But I volunteered to help that transition because we lost maybe 85% of our writing staff as a result of that decision. So. Jeez. I came on board to sort of try to help make sure that the culture survived and that we wouldn't lose our footing because of that. And, you know, I stayed. So we'll see what happens.
I mean, in this day and age, do you really need to have all the writers in the same office, or is it just a preference to have everybody in the same place?
Yeah, I mean, if I had been running The Onion at that time, I would have considered the whole virtual office thing and wouldn't have had a problem with that at all. I run my own little humor website now called Blaffo, and nobody's in the same space. We've never even met some of these people. So, yeah, it's all in the computer now. Of course, now with net neutrality going away, that website won't be happening anymore.
Jeez. Mm. Well, let's go back to the beginning. It says that you were the editor-in-chief starting in 1988. I didn't even know The Onion existed that long ago.
Oh, I thought you wanted to go back to the Agricultural Revolution.
Well, we can do that if you like. Yeah. It's just going to be a long episode.
Good. That's good. We can start in 1988. So, yeah, it was a print publication exclusively starting in the fall of 1988. It was a college humor publication in Madison, Wisconsin. And I got involved because I was a successful local cartoonist at the time, and I got roped in with these really smart business guys who were starting up The Onion. They wanted me involved, and I started, you know, drawing cartoons and writing, and pretty soon I was editing. And then a few months into that, they offered to sell it to me, and it wasn't worth much, but I liked it and I liked doing it. And so I bought in with a couple of partners and became owner editor at around 1989. And a writing staff slowly grew over the next few years, very organically, just sort of like the funny people in town would kind of gravitate to it. Or mm-hmm. I would see somebody being funny, like checking people out at the grocery store, and I'd say, "Hey, you ever write comedy? Come work for me." You know, that sort of thing.
Now, who was the audience at this time in the print? Like, how many papers are you distributing, and how tiny of an audience is this?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a cliche, but it's so true. Like, we were our own audience. We just liked entertaining ourselves. But we especially liked, though, when we knew that people on the street liked it. So it was like college students or people around town, and it was distributed, I don't know, maybe 15,000 copies on the street in Madison. And it was a unique thing. There were a ton of weekly newspapers, but none of them was a parody of a newspaper. And so it was really surprised people when you'd see it on the street in the stacks, along with all the other free weeklies or whatever. You'd see, you know, the local alternative weekly that would always have some, you know, thing about the workers and the unions on the cover. And then there was the LGBT weekly that would have a picture of the latest parade or protest on the cover. And then you'd have The Onion, where you literally be like, you know, a screaming headline, "Emperor of Saturn to enslave us all," you know. And it was just like a fun diversion from all the other media, all the other local media going on. People would clip stuff out. They'd hang it up on their dorm room doors and stuff. That's kind of how we knew it was working. Right. And the stacks would disappear throughout the week. Like, we knew people were picking it up.
Now, when you're sending out, did you have to like flat out say, "Hey, this is a comedy paper"? Did most people get what you guys were doing, or was there a lot of this didn't happen, this ain't real?
It was a mix. You know, people were definitely confused by it, because there had never been an overtly fake free newspaper like that. There had been the Weekly World News, like in the grocery store, mm-hmm. with the scientists amazed by Bat Boy and stuff like that.
The Sun.
And those are great, great publications. There was a writer from The Sun who used to go on Letterman's show, and super, super funny. He just played it so straight, like he believed everything that they printed, and that was kind of a gold standard for us. But still, like, even with those publications, grocery store customers presumably believe that shit. Like, a lot of them believe in Bat Boy and stuff like that. So there's always going to be those people. But, you know, people who were sort of hip to it knew we were making stuff up and enjoyed that. But it was a new thing, and it was weird, and people didn't get it. So we had to create the AV Club, which was the thing we put in the back half of the paper, where we had movie show times and reviews of actual entertainment products that people had heard of, because that kind of grounded the paper and made people realize that it was a legitimate thing that had legitimate information in it. Because before that, they literally weren't even using the coupons that we were running for local advertisers, because they assumed that coupons right. were fake.
Now, did you grow up like you said you were drawing and when writing, like, were you a fan of like Mad Magazine and things like that? Was that an influence on you, or you just kind of liked this on your own?
Yeah, I was definitely a Mad Magazine guy. I discovered it when I was in about third grade, and it was never thought it was hilarious. Like, I never was laughing out loud at it, but I just loved what it was, and I loved what they were able to do. They just could make fun of anything. And that was kind of a revelation to me. I came from a very serious family, just a very serious upbringing. I was a very serious kid. So yeah, that kind of opened up a lot of doors for me, just thinking about, hey, you know, you can make jokes and make stupid stuff. And so I started making little books. I'd buy like notebooks and make little comic books and ABC books. And I had a friend I used to draw with, and really got into cartooning, did cartooning in high school. And when I left high school, my goal was to, you know, somehow make a living as a cartoonist and kind of banged my head against the wall for many years and finally got a comic strip going in the Daily Cardinal, which is a Madison student newspaper. And then I syndicated that comic to other college newspapers and I sold t-shirts and books. And I actually had like a pretty decent living that I was making from my college comic strip before The Onion ever came along.
With The Onion, when it started, did you guys sit back and was it looked at as like a part-time thing? Something where you say, okay, this thing can grow and this will be a full-time job or just a side little thing for shits and giggles, for lack of a better term?
I don't know that people thought that much about it. You know, Tim Keck is one of the founders, comes from a newspaper family. So he knew like that you could own a newspaper and make money selling advertising. Mm-hmm. And he partnered with this other business guy, Chris Johnson, and they brought me on issue one to be like their, you know, cartoonist, I guess, for lack of a better word. I was helping come up with ideas and stuff too, and that role grew. But we all just loved it and we thought it was fun. And I think their attitude was, hey, if we can keep this going and we can feed ourselves, great. If not, then, well, we tried. You know, it wasn't really any like grander plan necessarily than that.
Right.
And it just kept going, you know, and it survived. And there were obviously lean years, especially in the beginning. It was very much seat of your pants. Nobody ever invested in it. Like nobody ever would have. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of the big money people that we went to early to try to get some help told us, look, kids, just quit. Just don't do this. It's not... What are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's inspiring to hear even. Like, we were just talking about this before you got on. Like, you know, the balls it takes to pursue something completely that you're passionate about without worrying about, you know, you're worried about failing, of course, but that's also kind of what drives you. So to take something like The Onion, a joke newspaper that you said people were like, yeah, okay, get out of here, and continue with it. You know, it's a little nerve-wracking, but it's interesting that you were able to kind of find it. Was there a point where you guys were like, okay, we're finally able to, we're able to do this? Like, was it when you guys started going digital on the internet, or was there a different point in time where it felt like, wow, this is something we can actually do?
It was a little bit before that. It was like early to mid-90s when it seemed like we had a pretty steady stream of advertisers who were getting good results, and we were making enough money to pay ourselves, and we had employees and stuff, and that was right. Feeling like, hey, you know, this is actually working and doing well. And then, you know, but I don't think we had grand aspirations at that. I certainly didn't. My only aspiration was I just wanted to be mentioned in the same breath as the Harvard Lampoon. Like I wanted to be seen as a legitimate college humor newspaper, which we weren't. We just were never clumped in with them. But then like in the mid-90s, the internet came along. We went online and then we started getting reviewed in national magazines. National TV shows were calling us, wanted to come to the office. They all thought we were the hippest new thing. And we also had sent a bunch of copies of The Onion out to people that we liked in the entertainment business, just like sent it to all the big agencies and some talent that we liked, and they liked it and they passed it around. And so it was kind of this insider thing, kind of like the South Park guys did mm-hmm. with their video. So we had people like Weird Al Yankovic and Bob Odenkirk telling all their friends, and those two guys are like super connectors, like they know so many people.
I'm sure, and so we
were kind of hip in the entertainment world, and at the same time started actually making money and selling bigger, more national advertising, increasing our circulation, getting more national notoriety, that by the time we went online, then it really seemed like, hey, this is actually a real thing. Like, well, then we started paying writers real salaries and health insurance, and they had 401k plans and everything else. It was pretty crazy.
Now, as The Onion was growing, what were you doing yourself on the side? Were you just doing the writing for The Onion? Were you doing stand-up, improv? I know you did some movies later on. What was your vision at?
Yeah, I liked doing The Onion very much because my real main goal was just to be in the entertainment business in some way, and that was a way to do it, and I liked writing comedy. But I always had a day job. Until The Onion started making serious money, I worked at a radio station. And Then I quit that and was at the Onion for a good 5 or 6 years where that was my only job. And then I left – or no, I left in that time to make my first feature film. And then I left again in around 2001 to make another movie, and then came back for a few years, left again, and came back again recently with the move from New York to Chicago. But – you know, I've always wanted to do other things, and I did get sort of bored at times with The Onion. But at some point, it became obvious that I was the person who knew best how to do it. Right. And so sometimes I would leave The Onion, and I would think I was out for good. But then the new owners would call me and say, hey, can you help? Can you come back and help us or whatever? And I just can't say no. It's like my child, and say yes. But I think those days are gone. I think they're not going to call me again because now they're owned by Univision and it'd be a whole thing.
Oh.
I'd have to be interviewed and I'd have to wear a suit.
Yeah. Yuck. Now when you what was I just going to say? The work environment. Now you guys obviously it's humor nonstop and well written humor. Did you guys try to keep it like lighthearted in the office, even though like. I don't know, like, eventually, what did you always have deadlines to meet when you went digital? And also, did you keep the paper going along with the website? And when did the paper phase out? And, like, did you guys try to keep – was it, like, a fun office atmosphere? Or did it actually become stressful at points?
There was no overt attempt to create any kind of office culture. I think in the best companies, those things happen just naturally.
Naturally.
And sort of from the top down. And, you know, the Onion office is always really loose and only one or two people had to worry about serious deadlines, and that was the editor. Everybody else could just sort of goof off and slack off. And sometimes people wouldn't show up for days in a row and they would never get fired because we liked their talent. So it was a lonely job sometimes for the editor who always had to meet the deadlines and get the stories in the paper in time. And yeah, we kept the paper going. In fact, the website was really just an afterthought. We'd do the whole newspaper. We'd come up with all the ideas for newspaper layout. We'd talk about the front page and the lead story and all this stuff. And then we would just take all that stuff and just put it on the internet, you know, without any added thought as far as like how to maximize that medium. But then, you know, the internet crashed. There was a big crash about 2001 where all these big internet companies and all this big fake internet money just disappeared.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of websites went under, but The Onion had this thriving print business that, so we were fine. And then in 2007 or 8, the print market crashed. And by then our digital was doing fine. So luckily we diversified and we always had a leg to stand on. But yeah, we phased out the papers really recently, like I want to say 2013 or something like that.
Wow. All right.
Yeah, which I'm sad about because I think the paper is great. I love looking at it in paper, on paper.
What's the structure at The Onion? When you have so many different people coming up with jokes, is it you give assignments to people about specific things? Like kind of what I'm thinking about today is... like, for instance, today with Trump, everybody wants to make the Trump joke, but it's too easy and you need different layers and all. Was there assignments given out, or did you just trust that everybody wasn't going to try to hop on the easy joke, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, for the longest time, I would say up until about 2012, there were rarely any assigned topics. It was just like, write whatever joke you want, and we'll sift through them all and pick the best dozen or two to run with. But then around 2012, that's when we decided we were going to be a website and not a paper anymore. And so we knew that what the internet was craving was for The Onion to respond to current events, which we never, ever did. Our lead time for a story was like 2 weeks. So everything was in production for 2 weeks before you'd see it. So finally, starting then, we'd be looking at the news and what's the big story today? Okay, we got to do a story on that. So we'd assign that topic. So yeah, if it's Trump or if it's something we're tired of writing about, still got to do it because it's like when you do a late night talk show, right. You do your monologue, you have to cover the big story of the day. You just can't avoid it. So that's where The Onion is now.
Now, are you your staff? Is it mostly writers, or do you get a lot of stand-up comedians to help out, or is it mostly people, script writers and newspaper writers and just comedy writers in general?
Yeah, more the latter. I mean, I can't speak to the current staff because I haven't been in the office in a while, and I think there's a good amount of turnover. In fact, the editor-in-chief and the managing editor just left. But, you know, when we came to Chicago, we did get a lot more improv people. We started getting them a little bit in New York. We'd get a lot of UCB people coming to work for us. But it is surprising that it's – you really get people who are very written word focused, I feel. Occasionally you'll get somebody with more of like a performing bent, but it is rare in my experience at The Onion.
Now, do you ever have an experience where one of your news stories – either went viral or people thought it was serious and got reported by different news outlets that got filtered to different people? Was there ever like an incident of like one particular story that you're like, oh my God, like, guys, it's fake. Like, it's just humor and people took it seriously?
Yeah, no, it's really entertaining when that happens. It's like,
it's great.
You know, I think a lot of these publications that sprung up around the election that called themselves satire and purposefully made fake stories to try to fool people. I think that's horrible. And The Onion never tried to do that. All we ever tried to do is write really funny comedy. And so if people accidentally believed it was true, that was their fault and we could laugh at them and we could all enjoy that. But typically somebody would point out to them, oh, dude, this is a fake. It's a satire publication. And they, you know, they'd be punked and everybody would get a good laugh. I think some of the big ones that I liked were when – this is recent. This is just a couple of years ago. The Onion named Korean dictator Kim Jong-un the sexiest man alive.
Hard to debate.
The Chinese – the official Chinese news agency reran that story verbatim. They ran all our copy. They ran all our photos, and they even added some of their own photos of the sexy dictator to augment the coverage. That was a good one.
So they're aiming for missiles everywhere except Chicago right now, North Korea. That's a great thing.
Yeah, no, we have insulated ourselves from their wrath.
Yeah, my favorite one of all is Jack Warner from FIFA, where he was under investigation. And he would. I remember he did a YouTube video. It's like, if FIFA's so bad and all, why is FIFA giving the United States a World Cup in 2015? And he was running with it under investigation.
Yeah, I remember that one. Yeah, a lot of the videos were believed because we spent so much money to make those look really authentic. And people are dumb. They just don't think to question what the information is that they're given. It's kind of a sad state of affairs.
Well, I mean, that couldn't be more true than today, right? All the things that scroll through Facebook, they don't even read the story. Like, you check the sources, and it's like conservativeeaglewarmonger.com. Like, it's something outrageous. Yeah. But
no, if I would have hoped to have achieved anything with The Onion, it would be to make people think a little more critically about what they're reading and to verify that it's a factual source. And I feel like, if anything, the opposite has happened. Because now people, they just see something in print and they're like, I saw it. I saw it. It must be true. I saw it in the media. It was in the media.
Yeah, you guys are like OG fake news, like the fun fake news.
Yeah.
Right. No, it's sad. It's
not the culture tearing apart fake news.
Mm. Right.
And tell us a little about your classes, the one you developed with the Second City Training, the Writing with the Onion program.
Yeah, so that was the thing. When we moved to Chicago, we thought, hey, Second City's here. We should do something with them. And we tried a bunch of things. We tried working on a show with them. We tried doing some like digital consulting with them. And then we tried the classes. The classes is the only thing that really stuck because people really like to – they like to learn how to write comedy. There's a lot of performing classes or improv classes and stuff. At that time, there weren't too many that were focused on the written work. And so, yeah, I had already written this book called How to Write Funny, where I kind of poured out all my knowledge about how to produce written comedy, which I feel like is pretty extensive, and turned that into the curriculum. And we have other Onion writers or Onion contributors teach the classes. And a lot of people come out of those classes and they get jobs in comedy. Like, we're really giving them the good stuff. A lot of them work at Clickhole and The Onion now.
Now, you being around writing comedy for God knows how long, for what, 10, 30, 40 years, whatever it is, do you find it hard to constantly stay, you know, stay unique and stay funny and not kind of repeat yourself comedy wise? And or is it more of like you're giving faith in like new writers and trying to form new groups? Are you still inspired to write comedy, or are you more focused on like teaching and the inside information on the comedy business?
It's a mix, you know, because I do think it's a young person's game to like be in the business working, coming up with jokes. And I'm sort of at the point now where I can see the code, like in the Matrix, you know, I can see every joke and how it works and why it works. And so I do get a lot of pleasure out of helping other people make their jokes better and writing books about how to do it. I do still write it on occasion. It is still fun to do. You know, I don't worry too much about innovating. I never really have. I just do what I think is cool and fun.
Right.
And sometimes it's innovative, and that's great when that happens. Like right now, I'm working on this podcast with some high school buddies. Actually, we're doing a series of parody adventure shows, like adventure radio dramas, which I haven't really heard anybody do. So that'll be unique, and they're super fun and super funny. But just like kind of a radical departure from a lot of the other things I've done.
You have your own podcast too, right? Like you have.
I do a little podcast where I interview people in the biz about how they come up with jokes and how they write jokes and like sort of about their process and stuff like that. So, yeah, you know, I enjoy that because like when I get together with people or I meet people in the biz, like that's what I love talking about. So I figure, you know, I should be recording these conversations. But other people might find it interesting.
Now, what is your process like your joke writing process? Are you a type it all out on paper kind of guy, or are you, you know, write it in a notebook kind of dude, or what's your process?
I'm both. I think those are two great methods because you got to generate a lot of material because most of it's going to be crap.
Yeah.
And so the more you can generate, the better your chance that you're going to weed through and find something that's good. So. Yeah, I mean, I laid out my whole process in my book, How to Write Funny, which I believe, I'm just going out on a limb and saying that I believe that's how everyone does it, because I've just known enough people in the business and seen how people do it. Some people just do it more instinctively, but other people can totally be taught how to do it. And the more they do it, the more instinctive it gets. But yeah, it's just about pouring out a ton of ideas and then having the tools to go through and assess which of those things works and then finesse them to the point where they're presentable to people.
You've done so much. You've written for The Onion. You've written for films, directed them, been a part of them, written books, podcasts. Is there a media that you haven't been into yet that you would really like to try out, some like comedy, or is there one that you found that you super liked or super didn't like on your journey?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that question. I've been in all the known media. I still do. I go to colleges and I give talks. You know, it's basically like an hour of stand-up because I'm just telling funny stories about the history of The Onion and stuff and answering questions. So I'm doing stage. I'm doing, you know, I do TV stuff. I do movies, print, blah, blah, blah. The one thing that I don't do much anymore that I used to and I love is street art. Hmm. Where you like punk people in the street or surprise people by performing in an unusual place where they don't expect. Sort of like what Bill Murray does. You've heard the stories of how he shows up, you know, he'll be pretending to be a homeless person on the street and suddenly you'll realize it's fucking Bill Murray and he'll blow your mind. And
yeah, my girlfriend walked past him reading poetry in the city one day on the street corner. Just
yeah, him no, reading. It's like, yep. he's amazing. So he totally, he gets it. Like that is the most powerful medium for comedy, but you don't see a lot of people taking advantage of it. The Onion did in its early years when it was distributed free on the street. That was like us doing street art, just appearing on the street and surprising people in a place where they didn't expect. But I haven't done much in person, which might be fun to get into again someday.
Now, how do you feel about the PC police world that we live in now? That it seems to be getting worse and worse and worse. And you're someone that's worked in the comedy field that, like Mike was just saying, several different angles along the way. Do you see, does that worry you at all? Do you just ignore it completely? Because, like, you know, I do stand up as much as I can and try to write and try to never think about, like, what a crowd might think of this or the reaction. But it still creeps into the back of your mind, like, oh, is this going to, am I going to lose the audience here? Do you worry about that in your writing?
No, I never have. That when PC first started, like in the early 90s, mm-hmm. we made fun of it a lot in The Onion.
Right.
And people say it's bad now, and it's bad on college campuses. I know a couple of big comedians stopped
yep.
going to college campuses because they didn't like that. But I still go to college campuses, and I've never once heard anybody say, oh, you can't talk about this, you can't talk about that. Ooh, that's offensive. This mm-hmm. is not. And, you know, I'll say whatever I want. I'll swear. Right. I'll make edgy jokes or whatever, and never had an issue with it. To me, like, PC just means being polite. Like, if somebody wants to be called a certain name, sure, I'll call them that name. It's no skin off my nose. I would prefer they call me by whatever name I want to go by, and that's all PC is. And it kind of bothers me that there are people out there who think that's outrageous. Mm-hmm. Like, no, if I want to call them midgets, I'm going to call them midgets. and I'm going to call those people retarded because that's the word I like. It's just like, it's rude. You know, it's just, I come from the Midwest. I'm nice. Somebody wants to be called differently abled. Maybe I wouldn't go that far, but I would call them, you know, whatever name they wanted to be called. And that's really all.
Right.
PC is to me. Like, don't punch down. That's the other part of PC. I think if people are punching down in their jokes, nobody likes that. Like, that's just not cool. And audiences won't like it. So
right.
as long as you're hitting the right target with the comedy and you're calling people by the names they want to be called by, you're fine. And I have no issue with either of those things. I think those are good practice.
Now, with all the different comedy sites out there kind of doing the same thing, making up fun stories, do you guys look at these sites as competitors or just good fun with other people doing their point of views? How's that viewed now in this day and age?
I mean, I view it as just other people having fun and people doing good work. Like, I love to check out The Reductress and some of the other, you know, sort of Onion-ish sites. You know, everybody thinks Clickhole is a separate site. That's produced by The Onion. But Liartown USA is probably my favorite website of all. Super funny. But yeah, I just love them and I think they're funny, and I don't consider them, like, there's plenty of audience to go around, and, you know, people always want to laugh, and yes, there is kind of a glut of entertainment. If people want to laugh, there's like a million places they can go now. But the competition is really only between, like, the huge people who have a huge distribution network and can get their stuff seen everywhere, and the little guy who doesn't have that ability. So I do like to sift through and find the little guys, people who are doing really funny stuff but just haven't gotten discovered yet. Those are the best people.
Now, what kind of current projects are you working on, and where can people go and check out your stuff?
Yeah, blaffo.com, BLAFFO.com is my humor website. It's just sort of a parody of Slate, I would say, but for the scary end times that we live in. And my podcast is the Comedy Insider Podcast. You can check that out. I'm on Twitter at Scott Dickers. Sometimes I tweet. And ask if you're a college student, tell your college to bring me out there. I'd love to come and talk to you.
One last question for you. Who came up with the name The Onion and why?
There's no consensus on who particularly came up with it, but there's a couple of reasons. One, we originally wanted The Onion to be a glossy humor magazine with a full color cover and everything. because that's what humor publications were at that time. They were magazines like Mad or Spy or whatever. But we couldn't afford that. It was way too expensive to print like that. So we asked the printer, okay, what's the cheapest kind of paper we could possibly print on? And they said newsprint. And my heart just sank because I just thought that would look so cheap and be pretty horrible. But then, you know, it was the only thing we could afford, so we went with it. And as a result, The Onion became a parody of a newspaper. And the name, The Onion, just seemed to fit because it was like you could peel back the layers to get at the facts, you know. Another reason was Chris Johnson, one of those two guys I mentioned earlier, used to eat raw onion on a piece of untoasted white bread every morning for breakfast. Very strange. And I believe it was his uncle who suggested that we call it The Onion. I don't know if the name had already been floating around, but he just like smelled onions when he went into the office, because those guys, the office was their dorm when it started. And then, you know, final reason I would say is, you know, you can never go wrong naming a product after a food item.
I guess not.
It's always good marketing.
Now, real quick, before you go, when you do these classes and you talk to a lot of young writers and people trying to get involved in comedy writing, do you have like a central message you try to tell them, or something, that advice that you would give people?
Well, it's funny you ask that, because I'm putting together this website for my book. I'm like terrible at marketing. Like, I've had this book out for 2 years and I've not done any marketing for it. I'm finally going to do a website, and I'm going to have a giveaway that's like my best tips for like to how to supercharge your comedy career. Because there are certain things like that you should be doing that a lot of people aren't doing, that if you did, you could shave years off of your dues paying period and really skyrocket into a more money-making position in the comedy business. So I'll give you one or two of those. So one of them is you got to be firing on all cylinders. You can't just be doing one thing. You can't just be doing stand-up.
Right.
You got to be doing YouTube videos. You got to have a podcast. You got to be writing and submitting writing to other publications. Because when opportunity comes knocking, it might be in a medium that you don't expect. And so you better have some experience in that. And you better have a pile of jokes ready to go to submit a packet when an opening comes up, you know. So it's all about being ready for opportunity when it strikes. And the other thing is like the whole idea of like writing jokes. You got to write jokes. You got to write them every day so that you start amassing this bank of funny ideas. Right. If you write like 10 jokes a day, like just 10 minutes, just bang out 10 jokes. They don't have to be great. But at the end of the year, you're going to have 3,650 jokes.
Right. Flexing the muscle.
That's like better than a retirement account. Right. Because then if there's an opening on John Oliver and your buddy of your buddy says, hey, you want to submit? I have an agent who will, you know, submit your packet or whatever. You do not want to be staring at a blank sheet of paper saying, okay, now what am I going to come up with? You want to go into your bank and get your best jokes and put them in there. Mm. So you need to be prepared for that.
Right. I like how you say you're bad at marketing, yet you worked with a paper that grew to a globally known source that people still talk about today. But, you know.
Yeah, but we never spent a penny on marketing. That was all like just because people liked what we were doing, which is the only way I've ever known how to market, is like make a great product and people will discover it.
Scott, thanks so much for giving us some time.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, anytime. And we wish you luck with all the different ventures you got going on, whether it's the podcast or writing, or maybe we'll see a pop-up again in some other media that we don't even know. Street art.
Thank you very much, and good luck with your endeavors as well.
He makes me feel like such a crappy comedian.
Oh, yeah.
Don't take much.
3,000 jokes here, I'm like, I'm still doing my same opener.
Let's see. 3650 minus 12. What was it? November? Oh, crap.
No, he is inspiring, though, because, like, all I think about lately is, like, I gotta write more, like, things down more because I'll put a little note in my phone and then I'll forget about it and I'll go to actually sit down and try to write again.
Dog treats? And what?
Like, exactly. And I'm like, what is this? Like, what does this mean?
Flubber on the moon. Flubber. How do I get there?
Flubber on the moon. But anyway, pretty fascinating, man. Fascinating interview. What you got over there? We got a few minutes.
Well, you know, we got Black Friday coming up.
Ah,
soon.
Yes. You shouldn't call it black.
Okay, African. No, that sounds worse. African American Friday. It's like so. It's somewhat worse than Black Friday. It's
great name for an episode, though.
But you know, we're getting all these deals from these different companies. Mm-hmm. But I know you will, Scott. I know you're a big spender. You love to just throw it out for the holidays.
You know it.
So I got a little game here. I have some of the most expensive items there are in the world of each set, and I want you to figure out which one is more expensive.
Okay. All right, so I just have to name... So you're going to give me, like, two items?
Yes.
All right.
All right, your choices are the world's most expensive chess set or the world's most expensive Monopoly board.
Oh, hold on one second. We have an update on the Duke's... not the Duke's...
breaking news.
Okay. So Irene Ryan, Google Irene Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
Irene Ryan was her grandma's sister-in-law.
Irene Ryan.
She was married to grandma's uncle Timmy, so an aunt through marriage. So it was my grandma's aunt through marriage. Tim and Irene were a radio team, much like Burns and Allen, but never that famous. Tim did a few bit parts in the movie, mostly playing an Irish cop. Stereotyping there. But Irene Ryan, what came up when you Googled her?
Well, let's see. She was married to Tim Ryan from 22 to 42. They got divorced. Then from 46 to 61, she was married to a Harold E. Knox and got divorced there, too. She was nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actress in the Comedy Series in 63 and 64.
Granny Clampett, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. The portrayal of Granny, the mother-in-law of Buddy Ebsen's character on the long-running TV show The Beverly Hillbillies, 1962 through 71.
There you go. Yep. I am in lineage of some grandma.
Let me, all right, search. Brennan. B-R-E-O-O. She appeared with Walter Brennan in an episode of the ABC sitcom The Real McCoys. Any relative of yours?
No, I don't know.
Text her back about Walter Brennan. Yeah.
That was a pretty quick response, though.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
All right, so your choices are... Oh, let me go back to my sheet. What is more expensive, the world's most expensive chess set or Monopoly board?
Now, I like to think these through. Chess set would be the one that jumps off to me because you think of like these real antique, like ornate chess sets, which is why I'm thinking it's the opposite.
Okay.
Because chess would pop off to me as the obvious one because you see those chess sets and like... hobby shops are like really expensive and beautiful. Monopoly is probably some like gold plated Monopoly thing or like real Monopoly or something like that. So I'm going Monopoly board.
All right. The most expensive chess set is from Charles Hollander, worth $600,000 with 320 carats of black and white diamonds. Only 7 of these luxury chess sets exist. As for Monopoly, the world's most expensive Monopoly board is a gold and jewel encrusted Monopoly game set on display Friday at the Museum of America Finance, estimated roughly $2 million.
Woohoo! One for one.
So which one of the nephews is going to get the Monopoly set?
I don't know. I guess Kira's getting that one.
Okay. Yeah. What would be more expensive? The most expensive slippers or the most expensive guitar?
Again, initially, guitar jumps into your head because there's some real expensive guitars out there, like probably a couple millions of dollars, Presley guitars and original Gibsons. But something tells me that the slippers are going to jump off as more expensive because that would be the one that I wouldn't pick. So let's go slippers.
All right. The most expensive guitar is from Fender Reach Out to Asia Stratocaster, which was made in 2004 and also signed by heavyweights like Clapton and Page.
2004, really?
Yeah, worth $2.7 million at auction. The world's most expensive slippers were ruby slippers from the house of Harry Winston, value $3 million.
Yes. See, this is what's going to happen, Burlo. If we play it safe and we don't do something, our slippers are never going to be worth anything.
Never?
No one's going to be bidding on Burlo's slipper. Like,
but Ben Savage has my face smiling and you can like step on it.
I might bid on that. All right, go ahead.
All right. What is more expensive, the world's most expensive pineapple or the world's most expensive cigar?
Again, going to stick with my logic here. Cigar would jump off. You think it's some fancy Cuban and it was made by Fidel Castro himself or something like that. But I feel like no one would think pineapple, so I got to go pineapple.
All right. The world's most expensive cigar is a Gurkha Black Dragon, retailed at $1,150 each, introduced in 2006. They are Honduran cigars, Scott. They are right. Not Cuban. The most expensive pineapple are pineapples of the Lost Gardens of Helgen, England.
Love that show.
Yeah, is the only place in British Isles that grows pineapples. The pineapples have cultivated by straw, organic fertilizer, and horse urine. Retail value, $1,600.
So what was the cigar?
$1,150. So you're correct.
Three for three.
Yeah. So that seems like a nice thing to give to the parents, a very expensive pineapple.
Yeah. Like, your mom.
Yeah, I mean,
thank you for raising me. Here's a...
They're very unique, as I'm showing them off to you.
Wait, so they're like, you can grow these things?
They're the only... Yeah, they literally grow them. It's the only British Isle that grows them. They're able to grow it in non-warm climates.
Now I know our business.
Cold pineapples?
Burlew and Scott, cold pineapples.
All right, Scott, would you want the most expensive house or the most expensive yacht?
Well, if you have a house, the most expensive house, I assume you pay most expensive taxes yearly. Now, I don't know how that works on a yacht. If you're out, no, if it's just a boat at that point.
Yeah, like, we should have really asked those people in Canada with their own island, with their taxes.
I want the yacht. I want the yacht because I don't need a big expensive house, but it'd be pretty cool to take you guys out of my really expensive yacht. Like, all right. Yeah.
So the most expensive house is Antilla Mumbai, named after the mythical Atlantic island of Antilla. The house is in downtown Mumbai, India, has over 600 full-time staff, retail value $2 billion.
Who lives there?
It doesn't say. Maybe they're renting it out, you know, make up some of that rent.
Right.
The world's most expensive yacht is the History Supreme. It almost hurts, doesn't it? It's made with 100,000 karat gold. Kilograms of gold and decorated with everything from T-Rex bones to miniature meteorites. This unfortunate case of what the heck do I do with retail value $4.8 billion.
I'm into the T-Rex bones and the meteorites. That's cool.
I mean, that's something to talk about while you're in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
Exactly, while we're pouring cocktails out in the sea. What else we got?
All right. What would you rather give to somebody here?
You ever gone out on Black Friday?
I've gone out a couple times.
I think I have. I think I remember trying to go to a Best Buy once and like being like, I can get a TV, and then I saw the line and just never went in. I was like, I'm not doing this.
I just remember one time I went, and there's like this huge line waiting for the store to open up, and they opened the doors, and I just noticed a couple of people were just walking in, not even worrying about the lines. I'm like, screw that, and I just joined them, and And some guy was screaming, "Hey, there's a line here." I'm like, "Hey, there's other people cheating too." So, all right, more expensive. The world's most expensive hamburger or the most expensive feather?
Hamburger. I feel like some hamburger would be like built with like made with like Wagyu beef and stuff like that. But a feather, maybe that feather came from like a endangered, like a extinct species, or it came from some like royalties hat or something. I'm gonna go with the feather.
All right. The most expensive burger that I can find is $5,000. It's a Fleur burger at Fleur in Las Vegas.
You say it so elegantly.
Yeah, I know. I know. Probably nowhere close to that pronunciation, but it's made with Kobe beef, foie gras, lots of truffles, burgers with a rare bottle of Petrus, and diners get a fancy glass that they'll get it poured into. So that's $5,000. For $8,000, you can get an extinct hooey bird.
Yes.
Just a single feather from the extinct hooey bird went for almost $10,000 at auction in New Zealand.
All right, so we got to sell pineapples and find some goddamn hooey birds.
Bring them back.
We'll be on our way.
All right, Scott. All right,
perfect score.
Yep, the most expensive cell phone or the most expensive motorcycle?
Oof. I'm thinking the motorcycle is more expensive.
The motorcycle, the Dodge Tomahawk V10 Superbike, four-wheeled 1,500-pound monster, goes from 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds, is retailed at $700,000 with a top speed of above 300 miles per hour.
Oh, that's nothing.
But the iPhone 3GS Supreme Rose by Stuart Hughes goes for a retail of $2.97 million. Whoa. They didn't really have many details to it. I mean, I was looking at it. It's just like, oh, look at this gadget. It's like, well, that's not really telling me why it's worth near $3 million, even though it's like 10 versions behind.
It's just a phone.
They got like diamonds on it and gold. I'll show you a picture of it, but they didn't give me any details on it.
That is so not worth it.
Yeah.
I'd rather the hooey bird feather.
Your friend zooms by on a motorcycle going 300 miles per hour. Look at me. That's nothing, man. Check my iPhone 3.
Yeah, right?
I'm smart.
Lame.
Lame. All right. The most expensive camera or 10 nights at the most expensive hotel room?
Well, personally, I think I'd rather do the 10 nights because it's an experience of a lifetime. I'm going to go the camera is probably the most expensive thing.
The hotel room, the Royal Penthouse Suite Hotel President Wilson in Geneva, with 10 rooms and 7 bathrooms, comes with a price tag of $65,000 per night. So 10 nights would be $650,000. But you can get a Sous Frisees doggerel-type camera.
Yeah. I'm just
dating back to 1839.
It's more fun listening to you read these pronunciations of these things.
Retail value $775,000.
Woo, baby!
And give you a little pic of you bought for $775.
It looks like one of those ones you go under the hood and just,
yeah,
boom, you know.
Now hold still for the next 10 minutes. This camera's awesome. All right. The most expensive television or most expensive piano?
I'm going piano. It's probably the most expensive thing.
Let's see. The television, the Prestige HD Supreme Rose Edition, goes for $2.3 million. Sewn alligator skin studded with an obnoxious amount of diamonds. This television is supposedly designed to make viewing a pleasure, whether it's on or off, versus the Heitzman Crystal. Made in Beijing, this 9-foot piano was recently purchased at auction by a private bidder for a cost of $3.22 million.
I just want money like that where you have nothing else to do. Where you're just like, eh. Like, you know, these people are just going to these auctions just to... It's more about the win. Like, to be the guy that does. They don't give a shit about the piano.
No. It's more get they probably get rid of it, and then they give it to a quote-unquote charity and get it as a tax write-off to get the money back,
right?
You know?
Exactly.
Want to do one more?
Yeah, one more.
All right. The most expensive watch or the most expensive bottle of champagne?
I feel like champagne, old champagne bottles from like France, like 100, 200 year old bottles probably go for a lot of money. Watches, we know can get a lot of money. I'm going to go with the champagne bottle.
All right. The most expensive watch is a Haute Joaillier from Chopard, worth at $25 million. The champagne is a Heidensack Monopoly. Monopole. 1907. Shockingly, only worth $25,000. Listed as the most expensive bottle of champagne.
Really?
No, yeah.
I guess that's still pretty expensive for... Yeah. A bottle of champagne.
Well, you're going to look so foolish coming up with that $25,000 bottle of champagne when you could have got your mom a nice watch.
I feel like you show up with a $25,000 bottle of champagne and it's not good. Like,
this is a little so flat. This is exactly. Weird. Yeah. Like, the expiration date said 2019. What the hell?
But, yeah, I mean, I think I did pretty good on the quiz.
Yeah. I think you got 5 out of 7. I want to listen to Old We Drink Water.
It's like the most unsoothing sound. Hello, hello. Hey,
I can hear you.
Can you?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe it's my headphones. Hey.
Hello. I can hear you perfectly fine.
I know. Why can't I hear myself? Hello, hello. Hey, 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 ho. Check, check, check.
Hi, 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 hi.
Weird.
Can you hear me through your headphones?
Yeah, I hear you nice. Okay, there I'm a little better. All right. Anyway, yeah, I hear myself.
Slipping connection?
I guess. I don't know. But, yeah. So let's wrap it up here. What do you got here?
I'm going to ask you about something. I found it kind of very weird. I was walking Callie through Huckleberry Park couple days ago.
Right.
And it's about 10 on a Monday or Tuesday, I forget when, but I'm walking her through the park and I notice like this big blue tarp thing hanging from the trees. Mm. And I walk over there and it's some dude in some like high grade. It looks like a hammock you would bring yep. to, like, the Alps. Like, you're yeah. climbing a mountain, and it's like, all right, we climbed for 12 hours. We got to get some sleep.
They have a lot of those now. They actually fold up into, like, a bag.
Yeah.
You could, yeah, I've seen that a few times, people hanging out. I actually thought about maybe getting a hammock. Like, it might be kind of fun to sleep out there.
I could see it, like, in the middle of the woods and right, when you're kind of by yourself or whatever. Even, like, off a trail, like, in an actual woods. But this is pretty much right next to a lake in a park on a Tuesday morning where, like, my first thought was, all right, you could be homeless, but at the same time, where'd you get the sweet gear with your homelessness?
I think you should have tipped him out. Like, just dumped him real quick while he was sleeping.
Gotcha! You've been shenanigans!
Oh, God. Yeah, go make a bunch of viral videos doing, like Green Man, but
you've been shenanigans.
People.
Oh!
All our massive listeners would yeah. stop listening.
I love your show! No, you don't.
No one does.
You do that, like, on a regular public park?
I've seen people at the place I walk, Obi, like, chilling out there. Like, they just sit out there and hang out in the woods. I don't know.
It seems like too much work for, like, a public park. If I was by myself, like, it seems like at least, like, an hour setting up to me.
No, the hammock?
With, like, you gotta find the perfect length for the trees, well, hanging it up.
You need two trees, basically, the length of your body, because the straps can, yeah. like, be adjusted. So
yeah, that's not a thing that you're going to find in 2 minutes.
I think you can find it pretty quick. There's a video you're going to make. I'm going to give you a hammock.
Uh-huh.
And you're going to put the timer on how long it takes you to...
Day 7.
I'm cold.
I forgot how to tie a knot again.
I'm so cold. I'm so sorry. Tell my mom I loved her.
I'm in the Blair Witch Project?
Yeah. Well, I just imagine you were dying.
Mm-hmm.
You
imagine that all the time.
I know. It's great. But I probably wouldn't do it in a super public area, but I don't know. I think maybe a hammock in the backyard or a hammock out on a camping trip wouldn't be a bad
thing. Yeah. Well, like, what, private property or mostly private in the woods? Not somewhere where, like, some, like, Girl Scout troop is doing a little hike and you're just waving from your little hammock thing.
I'm going to definitely break into your apartment and set up a hammock across your living room and just be sleeping there when you get home one day.
Scott! Get out of there! Hey, Berlou! My territory!
I don't know. I find it weird, I guess, a little bit, but not extremely weird. Like, I could see the relaxing part of it also.
I mean, it's
quite like, not that much like, weirder than people like taking out a lawn chair and sitting out in the middle of a park or something.
But that's just sitting out there. Like, it's like pitching a tent in like a regular park, if you will.
What about like when they take out a blanket and just lay on a blanket, like a beach blanket?
Yeah, that's simple. That's not.
I don't think the hammock's that difficult. We're gonna have to figure this out.
That's not even on a difficult range. It just seems like a very weird thing to just do in a public park.
Yeah, I mean, I see that. They also have these new. They're like sock, like big long like wind socks, and you like run and get air in them, and then you like tie the top of it real quick, and it forms these like air chairs, like these relaxing, like kind of comfy chairs. Pretty, they're like camping gear, kind of.
Okay,
but yeah, I don't know. It's a little weird. Mm. It's a little weird. But who died this week?
We had a few people.
Charlie's gone.
Yeah, old Charlie Manson left us. Malcolm Young.
He was surrounded by family.
Oh, hack a lantern. What are you doing here?
Oh, he's always here, unfortunately.
Everybody was running for that joke.
Oh, yeah.
Malcolm Young from AC/DC.
Yep, gone.
He went, I mean, he had dementia. I guess that's one of those if you got to go, yeah.
Yeah, that's a terrible existence, like just living with dementia, like not knowing what's going on and not remembering people. It's like erasing your life slowly. It's kind of weird.
And not to give him any extra stature, if you will, but like a life that he lived where it's like he probably had like thousands upon thousands of stories and it's just gone. And
yeah. Like, they play still every once in a while. Like, has he been in the band? Like, how long has he been not playing?
Like, last year, they kind of really... Now it's kind of like those bands where you're like, just give up the name. Because, mm-hmm. like, the lead singer left. Now, it was Axl Rose doing AC/DC.
Yeah, they actually
kind
of got rid of him. Apparently, yeah. Like, his hearing was becoming a giant problem. And, mm-hmm. Brewer talked about it. Like, I listened to a podcast. They were, like, really close, Brian Johnson and Jim Brewer.
Yeah.
And he was talking about how devastated Brian Johnson was about it. And, like, they didn't want to talk about his hearing to him. And there's definitely some, you know, band drama going on with them.
I think Malcolm went, like, 4 months before, 4 months after. It was relatively close between the two. So, Okay. It's... They're still touring, but you just like, come on, guys.
Like,
call
who's
it something else.
Bon Scott? Like,
I think that's...
What's the dancing guy in the stupid school uniform.
That's Malcolm.
That's him?
I thought that was Malcolm.
No. AC/DC members.
We prepare for the podcast every week.
Yes. Oh, Angus. Yeah. No, yeah. So Angus Young is the guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
But
Malcolm is
the rhythm guitar player.
Yeah.
So... Angus is the guy. Angus Young is the one that jumps around and stomps his foot. Wow, there's been a lot of members. Holy,
yeah. You just like
if you type in AC/DC members in Google, there's it looks like exact 16, 17, 18, like 19 members. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I guess if they have the two, they just keep going. But
as long as one's on life support, we can call it AC/DC, I guess.
Dude, I used to film all these concerts for the TV station I worked at, and there would be the doo-wop bands. And, like, the one guy was, like, living off of Frankie Valli. He was Frankie Valli's brother, and he would call himself, like, the Duprees and stuff. Like, it was just – they would all, like, just take names of bands, and you'd – ask someone who knew anything about them, there'd be no original members left, just four guys who somehow got the name. It's awful.
Yeah.
Who else died?
David Cassidy.
Damon Cassidy. Who's he again?
He was he was a singer songwriter. He was one of the Partridges.
Oh yes, 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 yes. All right, well,
yeah,
a lot of deaths.
Yeah, the grandfather on the Cosby Show. He 91.
That's a good run.
Yeah, that's a good run. I mean, you don't go aw, but you're like, oh okay. You
wonder know, when my relative died, the grandma of the Beverly Hillbillies. I wonder how long ago she did.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking, like, when Manson died, you kind of know how, like, with some, like, TV shows, they envision heaven with, like, this big line up to the pearly gates to be judged.
Right.
Like, some guy died, and he's like, oh, my God, this line is so long. I hope I get to talk to somebody, you know, really unique or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he just turns around, and it's Charlie Manson, and it's like, all right, I got, like, 100 years to talk to you now.
I would like to interview Charlie Manson though in his prime, like if we
in
die
in his prime,
yeah,
like right mid murder career,
mid murder, yeah, like the whole family's
not
there.
The first year, his rookie year, he was sloppy. He didn't have his stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to, you know, like say we're doing the podcast in heaven.
Okay,
I'm sure that's what you think heaven is. and Charlie Manson somehow makes it there. Like, he'd be one of the guys that'd be like, oh, we got to get him on.
First question, what the hell are you doing up here?
We had Lennon on last week and Charlie Manson. This day. Our guest list would be awesome.
Yeah. No, we don't want to talk to the following people anymore.
Melissa Allen.
No, we're not really doing that kind of podcast anymore. And, of course, our friend Kamala is on life support now.
Well, he might make his way out. Hala is for you, Kamala.
He has no legs right now, you know.
He has no legs?
Yeah, he lost them to diabetes.
Oh.
So he's just a stump in the emergency care.
Kamala.
When everybody still don't. It's like when he dies, they're like, do we have to paint, like, the stars and the crescent moon on his tummy?
What if he still has them on? Like,
seriously, sir, we know you can speak English. Just
what
talk
do you,
to us.
What do you think Charles Manson's, like, funeral or whatever, like, do they give him, like, a final ceremony or something? Or they just, like, bury him in a prison?
I guess if he still has family, they have a right to bury him. I think if he has no family, to just cremate him. And
what about his love family? Like,
are any of them still around anymore?
I don't even remember. I remember Sharon Tate was one of the names.
Yeah,
I don't remember anything else about them.
Again, the most prepared podcast.
Yes, yes.
In syndication today.
On that note, let's get the hell out of here. So, anything to promote, Burlow?
I'll just do my Facebook page, facebook.com/ TheBurl721. Tonight on The Walking Dead, there's 3 more episodes before this winter break, and I'm already working on plans with Izzy for the Hallmark movie reviews this coming this December, so check that out.
All right, and I'll promote Friday and Saturday. I'll be hosting at the Comedy Cove.
Old school.
Yep. With headliner Mike Burton. So I'll be there Friday, Saturday. Come on down. Have a little holiday drink with me. But, and we'll obviously promote the show. Guys, please share the podcast. Please listen to the podcast. Please go check out some of the old episodes. They're not even old. Like Scott said, I can't believe you guys put out one once a week. That's right. You know, mm-hmm. They're not even old. A couple months ago, episode last week, we had Arlette on. She roasted Burlow a bunch of times. It was wonderful.
Yeah, that was totally uncalled for.
Yeah. She was the singer. She's the national anthem singer for the New Jersey Devils. But before that, we had Trent Dilfer.
Irony Singleton from The Walking Dead.
Yeah. It's been a huge year as we crawl to the end of the year. We got should have another big guest on next week. Comment, share, tell people, like, hey, I enjoyed that. But with that, people, life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. You know the place where nothing is real. Well, here's another place you can go.
You sure went out on Kamala's theme.